It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll be joined by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty that is encouraging the state to give more rural families access to voucher schools.
First, it's time for our weekly check-in on the latest news out of Washington. President Trump is currently on his first foreign trip as commander-in-chief. We'll talk about his trip this morning to the Vatican, and the Supreme Court struck down two districts in a gerrymandering case.
We'll also take a look at the 2018 race for seats in the House and Senate. Both branches of Congress could face unique challenges with Trump in the White House.
Harry Enten's back with us. He's senior political writer and analyst for 538. Hey, Harry.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks. Well, President Trump this morning continuing his foreign tour, and this morning he met Pope Francis. What happened this morning?
Well, he met with the Pope. The Pope made fun of his weight a little bit, and it's the joke with Melania. But, you know, this entire trip has been very interesting to me because, obviously, it's Donald Trump's first foreign trip abroad, and he's spoken with a lot of people in a lot of countries who perhaps he didn't have such kind words with during the campaign. But so far, the trip, while perhaps not the greatest success of any foreign policy trip so far, has not been filled with any disasters. And, you know, in this White House, if you can go a day without a scandal, I think it's pretty good news.
You mentioned some conflict maybe with some of the folks that he's visiting on this trip, and the president did bandy some words with the Pope when the Pope was upset with Trump's plan for a border wall. He said it was not a very Christian notion, and President Trump took offense with that at the time. So that apparently was not a point of friction today.
No, it didn't necessarily seem to. Nothing certainly that's blown up on anything, and that I think is kind of the interesting thing, right? When Donald Trump is on the campaign trail, it isn't necessarily the Donald Trump who you get as president. Oftentimes they're very similar, but for instance, you know, when it came to, you know, saying Muslim terrorists or Islamic terrorism in the Middle East, he didn't exactly use that phrase. He was very careful to step around it. I think Trump recognizes that perhaps, you know, he wants to put America first, but America still needs to have a part on the foreign stage. And so I think he's kind of dialed it back a little bit. And while, you know, he's still Donald Trump, he isn't full-on Donald Trump, perhaps.
And the president is in Brussels now to meet with NATO. And this has been another point of contention. So based on past criticism of NATO, what do you expect from this particular meeting?
You know, I think it's going to be rather interesting, right? Because, you know, Donald Trump had initially, you know, said that NATO was obsolete. Then, you know, he comes back a little bit later on and says that perhaps NATO isn't so obsolete. I don't necessarily know what to expect. You know, I don't know which Donald Trump will necessarily show up at NATO. I think what you'll probably see is that Trump will, you know, probably toe the line as he has so far, not try and make too many provocative statements, basically say, you know what, maybe things need to change a little bit, the relationship with NATO and how it's exactly funded, but I don't think he's going to pull the U.S. out of NATO or anything like that. That would be news, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Now, as President Trump is on this foreign trip, there has been this huge onslaught of news in this country, in the U.S., about the Russia investigation. How does it play out? Do you think there's anything difficult about the president being abroad while these stories are unfolding here?
I don't necessarily think so, because Trump, if he's smart, wouldn't have very much to say about the Russian stories if he was in the United States anyway. If anything, the fact that he's abroad may keep him off of Twitter and may keep him out of trouble. I mean, Twitter is the place where he gets into trouble most often, and if he's busy abroad, and from all reports, he's also quite exhausted, which shouldn't be too surprising given, you know, the whirlwind tour he's on, he's managed to stay off of Twitter for the most part and certainly kept his more inflammatory statements off of Twitter, and I think that's actually been helpful for him.
We're getting the latest out of Washington right now with Harry Enten from 538. And Harry, you've been looking at President Trump's favorability ratings and how he's looking in the polls. What's the latest there?
Well, you know, look, Trump is lower than he was when he entered the White House. According to our 538 estimate right now, his approval rating nationwide is about 39%. But perhaps what's most interesting to me is not just that overall approval-disapproval question, but basically how strongly do you approve of this or disapprove of Donald Trump? And what we've seen is that those strong approves, those people who really, really like Donald Trump, which we used to be around 30% at the beginning of his presidency, has dropped much closer to 20%, which tends to suggest that, in fact, the Donald Trump base is not as strong as perhaps some people argued it was. And the reason why it's dropped could be linked to any number of factors, but I do think the healthcare, unpopular Republican healthcare bill is part of it, and I don't think the recent talk over Russia has helped one bit at all.
What about among Republicans, you know, registered Republicans, which would you'd assume to be at least a strong contingent of Trump's bread and butter?
Yeah, I mean, look, those numbers haven't dropped too dramatically. If you were Trump, you'd prefer a number closer to about 90%. The number is probably somewhere between 80 and 85%, depending on which poll you look at, which is pretty good based off of historical standards. But because Donald Trump is so unpopular right now with independents, with approval ratings, depending on what poll you look at, somewhere between 30 and 35%, he really needs to be strong with his base than he is right now if he wants to see a recovery in his approval rating.
Now, at 538, you guys recently talked about whether or not all of the issues, the questions swirling around the president regarding Russia have hit sort of a crisis point for his administration. What answer did you come up with?
Well, you know, I think it depends on who you exactly ask. And, you know, we have sort of bandied about it ourselves, as you mentioned. I don't think it's quite hit, you know, again, it depends on your definition of crisis, right? It's clearly something that has enveloped his presidency. There were questions about it pretty much every day last week. But it's not something that is anywhere near the point where it might bring the presidency down. And that's, I think, the real threshold that we should be looking at, is if it's something that can bring the administration down, then that's a real problem. For now, it's something that could, but it's not something that necessarily will, unless they get something on Trump himself.
Now, we had this discussion yesterday, sparked by a caller, about whether Congress and whether voters see the Russia investigation as a partisan issue. What do you think about that, Harry? How is it playing out?
Well, if you look at the polling data, what you do see is that his approval rating on Russia, and specifically his approval rating, you know, on James Comey, which, you know, firing James Comey, the director of the FBI, which is obviously linked up with Russia, we do see that that does tend to correlate with how you approve of Donald Trump, generally speaking, which, of course, Republicans do overwhelmingly so, while Democrats are the exact opposite. So there certainly is a partisanship to that. And as long as that's the case, Trump is probably going to be safe if your idea is that, oh, my God, this Russia investigation is going to take the president down, because as long as Republicans are behind him and Republican lawmakers are behind him, he's not going anywhere. So right now it is fairly partisan, but there are certainly poll questions that show that people want an independent investigation, and that in itself is bipartisan, which is what we're going to get with Mueller.
And so yesterday we had a couple big news stories. We saw former CIA director John Brennan talking about his concerns with Russian interference, and also the story that Trump asked two top intelligence officials to deny the existence of evidence of collusion between his campaign and Russia. That's the latest. So where do you see this investigation heading next, Harry?
You know, this is the thing that I just don't necessarily know, what Donald Trump is thinking sometimes when he asks these questions of people. I think he honestly doesn't. I hope he doesn't believe he's breaking the law. But this is something that happened with Comey as well, you know, obviously, where he spoke about, asked him, am I being investigated? Am I being investigated? And, you know, that's not exactly a proper question. But I think in terms of the larger scope of where this is going, whether or not they're going to find collusion between the Donald Trump campaign for president and, say, Russia, that probably not. But the longer this goes on, you know, the more you might think, hey, maybe something's there. But we're a very long way away from that occurring. And there's a big difference between the Trump campaign colluding with Russia and Russia itself trying to help out Donald Trump's campaign. And the latter, where Russia's just trying to help out, there's nothing much to be done about Donald Trump. But if, in fact, they do find out some collusion, that would be huge news. But we're still a long such way from that being determined.
Harry Enten is with us right now from 538. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538, and he's with us to talk about the latest political news from Washington.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on all the news coming out of the Trump administration? What do you think about President Trump's trip abroad or the race in Congress for 2018? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Harry Enten of 538 about the latest political news out of Washington.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on what you see right now in the Trump administration, or your thoughts on the race for Congress in 2018? And what are you thinking of President Trump's trip abroad? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Harry, this week, the Supreme Court struck down two North Carolina congressional districts, saying that lawmakers had violated the Constitution by relying too heavily on race when they were drawing the boundaries. Was that decision a surprise?
I think it was a, you know, I don't know if it was a shocker, but it certainly was a pleasant surprise to some and an unwelcome surprise or unwelcome development for others. You know, these districts in North Carolina had already previously been redrawn. So, you know, this is an old congressional map. But the thing that's so interesting here is that in the southern United States, race is basically tantamount to partisanship, right? Whites are, for the most part, overwhelmingly Republican, while African Americans are overwhelmingly Democratic. And the Constitution allows for redistricting, or to take race into consideration when redistricting, but not partisanship. So I think the bigger takeaway from this is that in the South, they may have, in fact, found a way to perhaps judge gerrymanderings in the South that used to perhaps only be judged along partisan lines, but in fact they found a way that they can judge it along racial lines, and that'll be an interesting development to see how other districts perhaps get redrawn or challenged in the courts. This was not the biggest shocker, but we'll see if it has a larger development going down the road.
And conservative Justice Clarence Thomas was part of the majority decision. Can you talk about that? Was that a unique move for Justice Thomas?
I think that perhaps was the more surprising thing. So you essentially had the four liberals or the four liberal stalwarts, and if they ever end up in a majority, that's a small majority. You usually expect someone like Anthony Kennedy, the more moderate Supreme Court justice, to join with them. But in fact, Clarence Thomas, very conservative Supreme Court justice, did. In this case, Thomas joined with them because he doesn't believe in racial gerrymandering at all. And so essentially what the decision had found was that they had used race predominantly, far too much so, in drawing these district lines. They tried to pack too many African Americans into a small number of congressional districts and said, hey, look, it's because of the Voting Rights Act that we had to do this. And Thomas never believes in anything like that. So it was an interesting decision where Elena Kagan, who wrote it, was able to bring Thomas aboard for a completely different reason, but I guess the liberals will take it.
So do we know anything about what this could mean down the road for other cases? I mean, Wisconsin has one in the pipeline, how this could end up playing out?
Sure. I don't necessarily think this plays a big role in, say, Wisconsin, where, you know, obviously the state's much more white than, say, in North Carolina. But I think it could play a far larger role in some Voting Rights Act districts in the South, African-American districts, Hispanic districts in both Florida and in Texas and perhaps in California and Arizona. Those might get challenged in a different way than they perhaps otherwise would have been. They may say, hey, you know, you're using race too much, and Democrats could challenge along those lines instead of trying to find some way to challenge it along partisan lines, which the Supreme Court has in no way really dealt with the issue of partisan gerrymandering and found any solution to that, while they've been perhaps more successful along racial lines, as this case illustrates.
Do you think that this is a coalition that could hold together on the court, the liberal justices plus Clarence Thomas?
I think that this might be one of those more one-offs than anything
else. In gerrymandering cases,
yeah,
though?
Maybe on gerrymandering, perhaps so, which will be interesting to see going forward. But, you know, each case is oftentimes unique in their facets. And when Clarence Thomas joins with the liberals and he's the only one, you know, my head kind of pops out of my cubicle and I go, huh, that's interesting, but I don't necessarily think that will hold.
Talking to Harry Enten right now from 538.com, talking about the latest news out of Washington in the last week. And Harry, apparently it's not too early to start talking 2018. You guys are writing about it at 538, and you're saying in the House, it could look okay for Democrats, and it looks pretty good in the Senate for Republicans. Let's start with the House. What do you see there?
Well, I think what we know from midterm elections from the past is that the president's party often does quite poorly. You know, they lose, I think it's something along the lines of 30 seats on average, and Democrats right now are 24 seats from a majority. So if the average, you know, seat loss held for the president's party, Democrats would, in fact, enter a majority in the House. And if you look at the president's approval rating, it's only at 40% among registered and likely voters nationwide. That would tend to suggest that Democrats would be in good position to take control. And indeed, if you look across the board, what we know from 2016 is that in a majority of districts, Donald Trump already got less than 50% of the vote. So Democrats don't need to win over any Donald Trump voters. They merely need to win over voters in congressional districts who voted for Hillary Clinton and who voted for third-party candidates. And when you put it all together, Democrats are in about as good a shape as you could be at this point, recognizing, of course, we're a year and a half away.
So how hard is it for Democrats to win over those Hillary voters? Is that going to be an easy kind of done deal in the bag sort of thing, or is this not a given?
I think for the most part, the Hillary Clinton voters are the easier voters to get. I think the larger question is what happens perhaps with those voters who voted for third-party candidates, voted for Gary Johnson in particular. They're not necessarily all that big of fans of Democrats. They're not that big of fans of Donald Trump either. I think that might be the sort of vote that gets fought over in 2018. If you go back to 1994, for example, when Republicans gained control for the first time in 50 years in the House, part of the big reason they did that was because the Republicans won a large share of Ross Perot voters. And I think this year, if Democrats are going to do it, they may have to win a large share of Gary Johnson and Jill Stein voters.
And looking at those midterm elections, is it fair to call this a referendum on Donald Trump, or is it more nuanced than that?
I think for the most part it is a referendum on Donald Trump, if we're being honest. You know, obviously Democrats start off in a better position just by the mere fact that a Republican is in the White House. That goes back through history. It's called the midterm penalty. But we do know that there tends to be a larger seat loss for the president's party when the president is unpopular. And that's part of what we've seen so far in these special House elections so far this year, where we've seen Republican candidates underperforming their baseline from the 2016 presidential vote. And so that would be part of a continuing pattern if Republicans were to do poorly in 2018.
So let's look at the Senate now. And this is a place where you say normally you'd say, hey, it's not so bad as you think it is for Democrats. Maybe some of this is wrong. But you're saying in this case, no, it does look sort of bad for Democrats and it looks really good for Republicans in the Senate. Why?
Well, I would say two things. It looks very good for Republicans if you're interested in only who gets a majority of seats, because Republicans right now have 52 seats in the Senate. And if you look at the seats that are up next year, there are, I believe, 10 Democratic seats up in states that Donald Trump won in 2016. And that in itself is a very hard thing for Democrats to be able to gain seats when they have to play defense in so many seats. Republicans only control 10 of the seats that are up next year, and all but one were in states that Donald Trump won. So there's just a lot of seats on the board for Republicans, not that many seats to gain, not that many seats for Democrats to gain. But again, going back to what I mentioned earlier with the midterm penalty, it's very rare for the president's party to pick up seats that are controlled by the opposing party in Senate midterm elections. So we'll probably be looking at something like a one or two seat gain either way. And given that Republicans right now have 52 seats, either of those would still leave them with a majority.
So getting back to this idea of the referendum on President Trump, you recently wrote about how all of the questions, the scandals surrounding the 2016 election in Russia, it hasn't really shaken voters' confidence in the system. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the pieces that I wrote, for instance, was talking about, you know, Donald Trump wrote about, has, you know, said a lot of things about voter fraud, and now he is, in fact, you know, doing a voter fraud commission to look into the idea of voter fraud. And there were some real questions as to whether or not Americans still believe in the vote counting system that we have in these United States, which, of course, is the fundamental basis for our democracy. And what we do see for the most part is people do think that the vote system is fair. That is, you know, if they cast a vote, it will be accurately counted. And those numbers haven't shifted too much. It's still about 75% to 80%. Or 60% to 80%, depending on which exact poll you look at. But those numbers have been pretty static over the past 10 years, despite everything that Donald Trump has said, which, of course, is a good thing, because if we're going to have a democracy, we need to be able to trust that the vote counts that people are putting forward are accurate.
But on the other hand, you say it has polarized things some. What do you see there?
Yeah, one of the things, you know, that I do see there, if you look at the polls, is that among Republicans, a lower percentage of them believe that the vote system for counting votes is fair. And that shouldn't necessarily be too surprising given everything that Donald Trump has said. But it's not like 0% of Republicans believe that. It's closer to 50 to 60% depending on what poll you look at. And that is in itself a little bit worrisome, because you want everybody from all the major parties to think that, you know, the vote count system is fair. And if things become too polarized and, say, Trump heading into 2020 declares, I don't trust any of the vote counts, and then, say, only 30% of Republicans believe the vote counts are going to be accurate, and then, let's say, Donald Trump loses, that could be a scary situation. But we're a long ways away from that. So for now, it's mostly good news, but there is perhaps a few clouds on the horizon.
So we're looking at that midterm election 2018. If you're a Republican who thinks maybe the votes don't get counted fairly, do you still vote? Do you still participate?
And this is one, I think, the biggest fear of the backlash is if you don't believe that an election is going to be fair, there's perhaps a chance that you won't vote. And midterm elections are, for the most part, largely about turnout, or, you know, a large percentage of it is turnout. You know, in 2014, Democrats didn't turn out when there was a Democrat in the White House. Historically speaking, when your party is in the White House, you see a lower percentage of people turn out than you otherwise would see if there was a president of the opposite party. And if you add on the idea that Republicans don't trust the vote counts, that could only hurt Republicans.
Harry, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Have a good one.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, with us to talk about the latest political news from Washington. Attorneys at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty are taking a closer look at how the state's school voucher program could better serve rural communities. Wisconsin's parental choice program allows some low-income families to send their child to a private school. Critics have said rural areas are left behind in this model because there aren't enough private schools outside of Wisconsin's more urban areas like Milwaukee.
But the law firm says this is a flawed argument that isn't getting to the heart of the problem. They advocate to loosen the family income caps on the program. Will Flanders is research director at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Will, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
And Colin Roth is research fellow at the firm. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Will, let's start with you. We often think that the epicenter of underperforming schools is in Milwaukee, but you point out that it's rural districts that are on the very bottom of the achievement data. What's going on?
That's right. When people think about sort of the image in someone's mind about poor performing schools, oftentimes I think we think, you know, of an urban district with concentrated poverty. But what we find is that many of the poorest performing districts in the state of Wisconsin are actually in rural areas. If you look at the top 10 lowest performing districts in the state, 7 of the top 10 are actually rural Wisconsin districts rather than the urban districts like Milwaukee that absolutely deserve to be focused on, but oftentimes may take too much of the spotlight.
So, Colin, how could vouchers improve education for kids in rural areas? Because there is this argument out there that private schools are often very far away for students in these remote areas to access.
Well, we are unapologetic advocates of parental choice. And as my colleague Will says, that, you know, the question of education reform and the education reform movement has too often focused on urban areas. And what we look at when we see the rural districts are struggling in the same ways. And with regard to supply of schools, what we do find is that in a lot of communities in Wisconsin, there are options. There are Lutheran or Catholic schools that could take students on a voucher, but the supply is less. But it's probably more than you would think it is.
But looking at the 2017-2018 county-by-county breakdown, it appears choice schools are located in about half the counties in Wisconsin, 37 counties I counted. So what about the kids who live in the other half of the counties in Wisconsin?
So we think that what we've seen, we looked at the Green Bay schools, for instance. Obviously, Green Bay is an urban area in the state. But what we see is that there's, you know, some high-quality choice schools located in that city. And in order to access these schools, parents are actually willing to drive fairly substantial distances. So we don't think just the fact that there may not be a school located within the boundaries of the county necessarily excludes students from accessing high-quality schools. Of course, there are some areas that are so remote that there may not be viable choice options. But we think this is a solution that works for the majority of students in the state, if not for all.
Yeah, about one in five private schools has an address. One in five private schools in the state has an address that's in a rural or small town area. But of that cohort, only about one in seven are participating in the Wisconsin Parental Choice Program. So we do see that there's more supply than most people might think.
So, Will, if the state would raise the income threshold for families to meet guidelines that are in place for the Milwaukee and the Racine programs, which is at 300% of poverty level, do we have any idea what would happen in rural areas?
It's difficult to get leverage on exactly how many additional students would be eligible if the income caps were raised. Currently, the income cap for the Wisconsin Parental Choice Program sits at 185% of poverty, which is similar to the thresholds for access to free and reduced lunch. Just to put that in perspective, for a family of four, that's an income of about $45,000 a year. So folks that with a family of four, that income obviously would be a struggle for folks to access school choice without the benefit of these voucher programs. On the other hand, you know, going beyond that, incomes $50,000, $60,000 a year, obviously for families like that as well, paying for private school tuition might be out of reach in a lot of cases. So we can't get leverage on the exact numbers just because it's difficult with the census data to sort of know the exact percentages. We do know it would lead to a substantial increase in the number of students that would be eligible.
We're talking right now with Will Flanders. He's research director at Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and his colleague Colin Roth, research fellow at Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And they recently wrote an opinion piece titled Rural Areas Need Voucher Schools, and that appears in the publication Urban Milwaukee. So today, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos answered questions before a House Appropriations Subcommittee, and defending the White House's 2018 budget proposal, it proposes to cut $10.6 billion from federal education initiatives. School choice would get a boost with $1 billion in grants that encourage school choice policies. And let's take a listen now to DeVos's opening remarks.
In total, the president's budget fulfills his promise to devolve power from the federal government and place it in the hands of parents and families. It refocuses the department on supporting states in their efforts to provide a high-quality education to all of our students. Research shows that increasing education options can have positive effects on students generally, and an even greater impact on poor and minority students. If we truly want to provide better education to underserved communities, then we must start with giving parents and students the power to select high-quality schools that meet their needs.
So, Will, we're a ways away from knowing how this 2018 budget will shake out. Do you see, though, more opportunities down the pike for rural voucher initiatives through this federal voucher push, and could that reach these rural areas in Wisconsin?
So we're definitely intrigued, and we're sort of interested in the national focus on school choice. We're glad to see this issue being brought to the forefront more. Without knowing the details of the proposal, it's difficult for us to say exactly the extent to which the new federal proposals would lead to access for rural areas. But we're definitely intrigued and think that the research that DeVos cites, particularly in the Milwaukee area, has shown positive effects for urban areas. We think there's no reason those results can't be translated to more rural settings.
Colin, in your research, are there any findings that you can point to that say giving more vouchers in rural areas, more choice, would boost school performance? Have we seen this done in other places?
I guess I'm not aware of research in other states, but what we do know in the most recent WPCP, the Wisconsin Parental Choice Program, those students scored about 6 points higher or 16% better on the ACT and about the same as traditional public schools. So here in the state, even with a young program, we have seen some very good results.
So while vouchers have definitely given poor families more choices, we're having to face is, you know, are children getting a better education? That's been really the rub in this whole voucher debate. Colin, do you see that by opening this up to more rural students, we could get a better read on how choice is doing in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and I think we would be the first to say that a rural school choice or even a statewide school choice program looks a little bit different in how it would function than in a place like Milwaukee. We understand that it's different demographics and that you're dealing with sparser populations. What it looks like today is different than this a place like Milwaukee. A lot of the students entering the Wisconsin Parental Choice Program, you know, only two or three or four or five or six from a district can enter, say, a Lutheran or Catholic school right now. And so that you're not seeing, at least with the current regulations and the current caps on income and enrollment, you're not seeing a massive wave away from the public schools right now. So right now, this program is small. We do know there is about a little more than 500 that were on a wait list. So we do know that there is increased demand. And we do expect that with options, the way that we know that education is not a one-size-fits-all model, we think that families in rural Wisconsin deserve the same type of access that families in Milwaukee or Racine have.
In rural areas, though, it would seem districts would be very sensitive to even losing a handful of students. Could this inadvertently hurt school districts that depend on an enrollment to make their schools function, to make their budgets function?
So I think it's important to note here that in general, at least at this point, we're talking about small numbers of students. So for the first year of the WPCP, enrollment was capped at 1% of students in a district. That's set to gradually increase to 2% in the subsequent school year, up to eventually 10%, and then the cap being removed. We think that the sort of gradual growth that's in place means that there won't be a huge exodus of students. We would like to see those caps raised more rapidly. We think the process that's in place right now is a bit too slow. But it's important to also note that for districts that are losing students, they are able to recoup the funds for 3 years for those students through raising property taxes. And therefore, the school has 3 years to adjust, which isn't something that's the case, or it's the same case as if a student leaves for another district or if they move to another city. So we don't think that the voucher program is going to have some huge existential threat for the public school system.
We're talking right now with Will Flanders. He's research director at Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, and his colleague Colin Roth, who is a research fellow there as well. They wrote a recent opinion piece that encourages the state to open up choice schools to more kids in rural areas.
And you can join us to talk about school choice at 800-642-1234. What do you think about expanding voucher schools here in Wisconsin? If you live in a rural area, would you seek out a choice school or stay in your public school district? If you're a teacher in rural Wisconsin, how do you view this issue? We want to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue this conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation about school choice in rural Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you had an opportunity to send your child to a choice school, would you do it? Why or why not? And if you live in a rural area, do you think the state's choice program meets the needs of your community, maybe your child? Join us at 800-642-1234 or post your thoughts on school choice at the Central Time Facebook page.
And Will Flanders and Colin Roth stay with us. They're with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. They recently wrote about why they think the state should expand its school choice program in rural areas of the state. Let's go right to the phones right now with Claire in Plymouth. Hi, Claire.
Good afternoon. You know, I have to say I'm someone who's taught at both private school and public school, so I understand the I understand what they want to do for those people who'd like to go to private school. I just disagree with them using public funds, because as someone who's worked in both settings, I've seen what's happening. We live in a place where we're possibly one of the lowest spending districts in the state, and we are continuing to fight issues like overcrowding of classes and all those kinds of things. My problem with these school choice advocates and with vouchers and other things is that the people who receive vouchers and the schools that receive voucher students are not subject to the same standards as public schools. And I really see that down the road that there is going to be a huge effect. I totally disagree with I can't remember which one it was who said there's not going to be an effect on public school, because the pie is not getting any bigger. We are not getting any more funding. There's not going to be any, and all we've seen is a decrease. All we've seen is a decrease over the last, so especially since Act 10, and it's not getting any better for public schools. And so while I appreciate the people who want to send their children to private school, I think to take money away from public school, especially in those low, in those districts up north where they have the problems, and they don't have, there aren't as many opportunities for them, not private schools, without taking money away from the public school.
Okay, Claire, let's get a response here.
Yeah, so I think there are a couple points in there that we could discuss. One point is, I think the common perception is that we've seen declining funding for public schools year after year in Wisconsin, particularly since 2010. And while there was one year where the budget was actually cut in the sort of aftermath of the Great Recession as the funds from the federal level declined, what we've actually seen is that at a per student level, we've seen funding increase in Wisconsin every year since that one year in which there was a cut. And currently, in 2016, the most recent sort of finalized budget data that we've had, we're very close to the highest level of per-student spending that we've ever had in the state. If any of the proposals that have been bandied about go through with increases in per-pupil funding, we'll be well beyond the highest level of per-student funding that we've ever had in the history of the state of Wisconsin. With regard to, you know, issues with overcrowding and issues in individual school districts, I think the perspective that we like to maintain is the perspective of the parent who's struggling to send their kid to a better school. And, you know, we'd like to think that, you know, it's fundamentally unfair that a parent in rural Wisconsin doesn't have the same opportunity to send their child to a better school that a student in Milwaukee does. And, you know, there may be some issues that school districts will have to wrestle with as we see choice expanded. But I think the most important perspective to keep in mind is the perspective of parents and students who simply want better opportunities for their kids.
Another issue Claire brought up was not exactly a level playing field. Private schools can choose what kids they will accept. And public schools will educate all students. So it's not really an apples to apples comparison.
Well, I would say that's not entirely true, that private schools, especially in the voucher program, cannot pick their students. They cannot discriminate in any way. So I guess I would disagree with that.
Let's take another call now. Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'm a teacher who has taught in a rural school district for 30 years. I'm retired now, but I continue to teach in a rural school district, and I've lived in a rural school district all of my adult life. And the proposal to create more voucher schools in rural districts will hurt local schools here. There is no doubt about it. We already suffer from declining enrollment. Your guest's discussion about how districts can raise property taxes for 3 years after they lose students, that's a lose-lose proposition for rural schools. I mean, nobody wants to see property taxes raised. Local people would see that, again, as another slight against them. We already have all kinds of alternative programming within our schools here, so it's not as if parents don't have a choice. And as to funding for public schools, I don't know where your guests are getting their statistics, but since 2010, public school funding has dropped by $1 billion. Now, Walker, here in this election year, or as we come up on an election year, is proposing to raise school funding by about $600 million, but that won't come close to closing that gap. And finally, This year, for the first time ever, pupil funding for voucher students has exceeded that for public school students. So overall, I think this whole push for voucher schools has always been a plan to hurt the public schools, to basically take on the public schools. And as a teacher and someone who has lived in rural northwestern Wisconsin for 40 years, I'm totally against it.
Steve, quick question. You mentioned there are alternatives in the district. What do you mean by that?
Well, the three districts within our county here, and we're a very small county, we've got one stoplight, total population of about 12,000 people year-round, have banded together to come up with an alternative school that's centrally located here in the county. So we have alternative school programming. We have RTI programming within all of the schools. That's response to intervention programming, where students are, if they're not making progress within the regular school setting, they are able to get specialized programming in the form of RTI programming, and if that doesn't work, then they also can get special education programming. So it's kind of a fallacy to say that there aren't choices within the public schools. Generally speaking, parents can look at teachers in the grade their student is going into and have some choice there too. And when you get right down to it, in any school setting, it's the teachers, it's not the school.
Colin, thank you, Steve. I want to give you, Colin and Will, a chance to respond. You know, a lot of the schools on the list are Christian schools. Can this choice also be about religion?
I mean, it could be, depending on what the parent wants. But I think there are other aspects to this school choice debate. I mean, we didn't even talk about charter schools. And I think what the caller even mentioned with different public school options. I mean, we don't really find, another form of school choice that no one really objects to is kind of open enrollment, in which a student can go from one public school district to another. That's the same type of thing in which a student is quote-unquote leaving a district and going to another one. We think that the options here in a place like Milwaukee and Racine, where we provide options to lower-income families, we would just like to see those expanded to rural families.
Well, thanks, Steve. Let's take another quick call here. Jill in Onalaska. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a comment about my concern with the voucher system for rural schools is that I think another caller already touched on that, is the fact that we have a pretty small budget already in the rural school district. And I think expanding the voucher system to include rural schools might further, depress those areas and take away from the quality that's available in the public school environment. And that would be my main concern.
Colin or Will, do you want to respond to quality concerns?
So I think it's worth emphasizing here that under voucher, the WPCP system currently in place, school districts will maintain the same funding per student, whether one student leaves or whether a larger number of students leave. So student-by-student funding levels do not decline. And in some cases, over the short term, funding levels per student may actually increase briefly when students leave the system. So just as Colin mentioned, if students leave to move to another district or if students leave to move to another state, the district has to adjust. As fundamental believers in the free market, we think that the voucher system will maybe serve to improve the public schools as well. And in that sense, it's just another force that all sides will have to reconcile just to give students and parents a better opportunity to educate their kids in the environment they think is best for them.
Well, Will and Colin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Will Flanders is Research Director and Colin Roth is Research Fellow. They're both at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. It's based in Milwaukee. And they joined us to talk about a recent piece they wrote in the publication Urban Milwaukee that is encouraging the state to expand its voucher offerings in rural areas of Wisconsin. And you can also make your comments on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think about school choice and how it is impacting areas in rural Wisconsin? You can make that on the Central Time Facebook page. nostalgia is always in style, but it seems to be having a huge cultural moment right now. Yesterday, we talked about how the TV show My Little Pony was helping to fuel the current craze for the rainbow-colored food movement, also known as unicorn food.
And as if that's not enough, news is out today that the huge blockbuster movie Top Gun is getting a sequel. Tom Cruise is reportedly back in the saddle as the gum-chomping Maverick, and Val Kilmer is coming back as Iceman.
This was a huge movie for Gen Xers like you and me, Veronica. Mm-hmm. Yes, it absolutely killed at the box office, and it launched a craze for beach volleyball and my favorite, aviator sunglasses.
Here's a clip of Iceman butting heads, as he liked to do with Maverick, over his flying style.
You guys really are cowboys.
What's your problem, Kazansky?
You're everyone's problem. That's because every time you go up in the air, you're unsafe. I don't like you because you're dangerous.
That's right. Ice, man, I am dangerous.
That also became your catchphrase, right, Kate? I am dangerous.
I'm dangerous. It takes me not. Back. It takes me back, Veronica.
I know. I like the sunglasses, though. Well, we'll have to see what happens with Top Gun, the sequel. You're listening to Central Time.